Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why Capitalism, lecture number four. This is the second to the last lecture in the course. This course is only five lectures. It seems like just a short time ago we were starting the course, and now it's nearly over. I suppose the reason it seems like such a short time ago that we're starting the course is that it was a short time ago that we started the course. Now, after next week, assuming I'm still around after next week, I'm having a one-week break, and then I'm giving another course that I hope some of you will be interested in called Broken Capitalism. In this course, we're trying to explain what's good about capitalism. And in the other course, we'll be explaining what happens if you try to interfere with capitalism. Of course, we've done that a little bit in this course, but that'll be the subject of the next course. I hope to see some of you in that course as well. Now, I wanted to start today. A lot of what we're saying today will be review, but there's some, I think, some new angles on things that come in the reading selections we had for this week. I wanted to focus first on what I think is a very interesting view of history that Mises and Henry Hazlitt have. And when Mises was writing the essay we had to read, I think it was written in 1952, he anticipated a way of looking at history that has become much more popular since he wrote. Now, I don't know that he's going along with this altogether, but at least in one respect, he is anticipating this new viewpoint. And in the old way that is, I'm sure you've had in your courses, you have various periods of history. You have the ancient world, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, Romantic period, and so on. So there, in that view, there are various important transitions in history, from the start of history to the present. But in this newer view, which you find in some economic historians today, is something like the really important transition was at the end of the, in history, was at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. That was really the period of takeoff. That was really the most significant transition. And the reason those historians, such as, I think, there's an economic historian, Gregory Clark, who has a cleverly titled book called Farewell to Alms, ALMS. And what those historians say is, well, before the Industrial Revolution, nearly everybody, except for a very small upper class, was living in very bad conditions. People really were just scraping by. But since the Industrial Revolution, since the late 18th, early 19th century, things have gotten a lot better. Some people still live in poverty, but there was really, for the first time in history, masses of people were able to live on a more than subsistence level. What I thought was very significant is that Mises and Hazlitt stress this also. Now, they don't say, so far as I know, that was the most significant transition in history, although they don't exclude that view either. But they do, what they have in common with this newer view is that they stress how bad things were for most people before relatively recent times. That up till the 18th century, really, life wasn't very good for nearly everybody. For example, if you look at the Henry Hazlitt selection, he gives a long list of famines throughout history, that every few years ago, masses of people were starving. It's difficult to read that list without laughing. And never mind that one, just a bad attempt at a joke, just forget that. Forget that I said that. But he says that really people say we today take for granted we can just go down to the store and buy food, but that wasn't the case for most people throughout history. Most people had to really work to grow their own food. Today, just a very small percentage of the people work in agriculture. I think in the U.S. it's something less than 2% of the people work in agriculture. But for most of history, nearly everybody had to work very hard labor on farms, and many times they wouldn't have enough. There'd be famines. And in addition to that, people didn't have, they lacked features of life we take for granted today, such as one I thought Hazlitt mentioned was especially significant, light. I mean, we take for granted that we have light inside our houses, but for a lot of history, that wasn't the case, that when it got dark outside, you would be in the dark, that people didn't have means of illumination, they didn't have light, so they would really have to watch TV by candlelight in those days. They didn't have heating. They didn't have indoor plumbing. All sorts of things we take for granted today were not present in much of history. And I think sometimes when one's reading history, people get a misleading impression, because a lot of history will concentrate on the people who sort of the great historical actors who were living at much higher standards of living than most people. And we tend not to think of how bad conditions were. There was one medieval historian who taught at Cambridge, George Gordon Coulton, C-O-U-L-T-I-T-O-N, who stressed in his work on the Middle Ages how bad things were for most people. So he, to some extent, anticipated what Mises was saying here. One of my teachers, Gerhard Lodner, was one of the great medievalists, was very critical of Coulton. He said, well, it's as if you were writing a history of the United States just from the prison records of society. But even though, if you just kept concentrating on how bad things were for people, it leaves a lot out, it is something very much worth noting. So things were really so bad for most people that when Thomas Malthus wrote in 1798 in his essay on population, it looked like he was just making an empirical generalization, a well-founded empirical generalization of what was actually the case. Because remember, what he said was the standard of living of the masses couldn't rise above subsistence for very long. He said most people, almost all people, will just be living on what they need to barely to survive. They won't get more than that. So he intended his essay to be a criticism of some of the Enlightenment reformers like William Godwin, the anarchist thinker, who was saying things could get radically better. And Malthus was saying, no, they're not going to. The mass of people are going to be at a subsistence level. So it turned out Malthus was wrong about that. But at the time he was writing, it looked like somebody was just making kind of a cautious judgment. This is the way things have always been. A great mass of people have never really gotten beyond subsistence. So it looked like he was right. Now, Mises says that Malthus's view, that statist view, that people won't get beyond subsistence. If you combine this with the iron law of wages, remember what the iron, do people remember what the iron law of wages is? I think we talked about that in some of the earlier lectures. Do people remember that? Well, remember the iron law of wages, similar to what Malthus said, if wages rise above subsistence, then workers will just start having more children, and then this will increase the labor pool, and that'll, you know, when you increase the supply of something, that lowers the price, so it'll push wages back to subsistence. So what Mises says, well, in Malthus's view, remember Malthus was, what field was he in? He was a professor of political economy. He was an economist. And of course, the main person the Iron Law of Wages is associated with, David Ricardo, also an economist. So Mises says the reason Thomas Carlyle called economics the dismal science was because of this view that Malthus and Ricardo had, that conditions really aren't going to get better for the masses of the people. Now, Thomas Carlyle was one of the great English romantic writers. I should be shot for saying that. He was British, but not English. He was Scottish. Very definite distinction there. He was definitely not an Englishman. But Carlyle was a very strong opponent of the free market. He had the extraordinary prose style. He stressed the role of the great man in history. Some people, such as the great 20th century philosopher and intellectual historian Ernst Cassirer, view Carlyle as a precursor of fascism. If you're interested in that, you should look at the chapter that Cassirer devotes to Carlyle in his book. I think it's called An Essay on the State. So, in any event, Carlyle said that economics is a dismal science. So Mises was giving a very common view, said that the reason Carlyle called economics a dismal science is it had these dismal conclusions about workers. However, there's some later research by David Levy, who's an economist who teaches at George Mason University. He's a very good intellectual historian. It appears that that wasn't what Carlyle had in mind when he called economics a dismal science. What he objected to was, remember, in economics, we have with Adam Smith and also Ricardo, we have the notion that people really can cooperate with each other. People are in some sense equal, in the sense people have different abilities, but we can all benefit from peaceful cooperation with other people. We've covered this in other courses, the law of association or law of comparative cause. You can, even if you're better at somebody in everything, you can still benefit from trading with that person. So you get an economics view, people can cooperate peacefully. And also in the tradition that starts with Adam Smith in economics, tends to stress that people aren't that markedly different in hereditary abilities. It's really the environment and the education people have that account for their differences. Mises doesn't hold that view, but that is a view that some economists, especially Smith and his followers, held in the early 19th century. So Levy suggests, and I put a link here, you can go to that if you want to look at what he said, that Carlyle didn't like that because he was a strong supporter of imperialism and racism. He was talking about the need for the superior races to establish empires and keep the lesser races in line. He was very much against equal rights for people he considered inferior. So what Carlyle was objecting to is that economics was spoiling things for him in his advocacy of racism and imperialism. So that's what made it a dismal science for him. I would say that is I think Levy's made a very good case for that. So if you're interested, that would be something you might look at. But to get back to the this view of history where we say, well, look, for the masses of people until relatively recently, until the Industrial Revolution, things were really bad. People had it, were really in a very bad way. Conditions in England, I left an eye out of in, were really particularly bad. It wasn't as bad, say, as in conditions in England weren't as bad, say, as in Germany after the 30 Years' War, 1618 to 1648, when about one-third of the population had perished, but they were still pretty bad. What was happening was that the population was increasing, but there were no jobs available for the new people, so there's some population increase that happens. So it's hard to say why it was happening just then, but it did. And because people were stuck in a way of doing things, they just followed kind of traditional patterns of living, just had most production was in agriculture. There weren't jobs available for the new people. So unless the economic system could be changed and people would starve. And remember, as Hazlitt pointed out, there have been there have been many, many famines in history. So it looked like, well, this might be going to happen again. People would just, there are no jobs available for all these new people coming on the scene, so they're going to starve. So things didn't look good. But despite these very bad conditions, when looks like the population is increasing in Britain, but there aren't jobs available for a lot of the new people, conditions improved rapidly in the 19th century, right after this very bad period. Malthus is writing 1798, he says, look how bad things are. People are never going to get above subsistence, and it looks like maybe there's some people who won't even get to subsistence because there's no jobs for them. But if we look at the 19th century, the population kept going up, but the standard of living started increasing, so a lot of people were able to get much more than subsistence. And I should mention, I referred to this briefly in one of the other lectures, there's a big controversy about when the standard of living increased. There is an older view which you find Karl Marx had in the first volume of Das Kapital, which came out in 1867. What he claimed was that the Industrial Revolution had really made things worse for workers at first. People had been really ground down in the new factories, and he had a lot of followers. One in the 20th century was a historian who just died a short time ago, Eric Hobsbawm. He lived well into his 90s. I think it's quite significant that Hobsbawm was for a long time a member of the British Communist Party. So the communist interpretation, which was held not only by communists, was that the Industrial Revolution had worsened things for workers. But other historians, those more sympathetic to classical liberalism, have shown that that view wasn't true. There's one that T.S. Ashton, who taught at the University of London, and then there was an Australian historian named Max Hartwell. I met him once. It was in a conference in Eugene, Oregon in June 1979. He was one of the lecturers there. So what Ashton Hartwell said, well, said, no, if you look at the more carefully at what the how workers were doing, things were better for them even from the start of the Industrial Revolution. So this Marxist view that says conditions were not very good for the workers in the Industrial Revolution wasn't right. You can look also, there's a book by Deirdre McCloskey, I think called The Bourgeois Virtues, that goes into this controversy in great detail, also arguing that the Industrial Revolution greatly benefited workers. But what I want to stress now is not so much that I think this older interpretation is wrong. Remember, the older interpretation is that the conditions Industrial Revolution worsened the position of a lot of the workers. And then the newer view is, no, it didn't. I think the newer view is sounder. But the important thing to realize now is, even if you accept this older view, which I don't think you should, everybody agrees that sometime in the 19th century, things were much better for workers than they had been before. And the Marxists have a lot of trouble with that, because Marx thought that the workers were continually being pushed down and conditions are always worsening for the workers. He calls it the immiseration of the proletariat. And they have a very difficult time explaining how Marxism can still be true given that things are getting better for workers. So everybody agrees, even if you think, well, things weren't so good for workers at first, or things were worse than before for some workers, everybody agrees things got a lot better than they'd been before sometime in the 19th century. So we then have to ask, well, if things were getting so much better, how did this come about? What's the source of economic progress? How did things get better? And one thing Mises emphasizes, the answer is not to be found just in the fact that people had better ideas, say, on how to produce things in the late 18th, early 19th century than they had before. That was true. People came up with all sorts of new inventions like the steam engine and the spinning jenny, whatever that is. I thought when I first heard that term, I thought it was a person, but apparently it isn't. So the ideas aren't enough. And to show this, Mises compares conditions in India when he was writing in 1952 with conditions in America. Now, India was then under the government of Nehru, Jawaharlal Nehru, who was the leader of the Congress Party. He had been, he was a British educated, he was educated in England. He was a very well educated person. And when he, Nehru and other people in the Indian government at the time had been very strongly influenced by Harold Lasky. Do any of you know the name Harold Lasky? Has anybody read Harold Lasky? Well, Lasky was a professor at the London School of Economics. He was a professor of political science who was very influential on a lot of foreign students. He was he isn't read that much now, but he was an extremely good lecturer, a very popular lecturer, and he was not, he was very sympathetic to Marxism. He wasn't a member of the Communist Party, although people suspected that he was, but he turned out he wasn't. But he thought very highly of the Russian Revolution, and he thought that communism was fulfilling certain religious aspirations of Christianity. He wrote a book called Reflections on the Revolution of Our Time. He didn't have such a good prose style. In fact, George Orwell, in a famous essay on English prose, uses Lasky as a bad example but of how not to write. But Lasky was very influential. And I say Nehru and others in the Indian government were very much influenced by him. Another one was the foreign minister, V.K. Krishnamenon, who was, if anything, to the left of Nehru. And besides Lasky, people in India were very influenced by the British Fabian socialists, who were saying, well, we need to establish socialism, but we have to do it by an elite operating gradually rather than through a revolution. So the dominant mood in India was in favor of socialism. Mises thinks this is extremely important in explaining why India, when he was writing, was doing much worse than America was doing economically. So for what from our purposes, is what's important here is the emphasis that Mises makes on this point that in explaining prosperity, just having superior ideas isn't enough. It isn't enough that people know all about these new technological innovations. And to show this, Mises points out, says, well, scientists and businessmen in India had access to the same technological information as people in the West. A lot of the people in the Indian elite had gone to Oxford and Cambridge and University of London. They'd studied the same things that people in England did, but still they were doing not as well. And what was lacking? Well, the key point that Mises stresses, remember we discussed this a little bit, we're talking about the entrepreneur in one of the previous lectures, is that Mises thinks that ideas have to be backed with money. So if an entrepreneur, let's say someone who has an idea, some change in production that he thinks will make a lot of money for him, thinks people are doing things in a way that can be improved, he can change things around, produce more of something or some new good completely, so he can make a lot of money. Mises thinks it isn't enough that he has an idea, this has to be backed up by money. Somebody has to actually make the investment. And this is one point, remember I mentioned last time, I think it was, that there's a difference in emphasis between Mises and Israel Kirzner, who also wrote on the entrepreneur from an Austrian point of view. And Kirzner stresses more the alertness, the perception of the possibility for gain. But Mises has that, but he says, no, well, you have to actually back the idea up with something, as they say, put your money where your mouth is. I don't think Kirzner would deny that, but it's just a somewhat of a difference in emphasis. At one point, just as kind of a side point, I put this in because on the quiz I gave for the last lecture, there were a few people who missed this point. When we're talking about entrepreneur, that somebody who says, well, I see an opportunity for profit, so I'm going to change it. The entrepreneur doesn't have to rely on technological innovation. One way you can act in an entrepreneurial way is if you come up with some new invention, say you've got the new, your new steam engine, so you're going to be able to improve things. But you don't have to do it that way. I mean, supposing you just say, well, I think people will buy more tennis balls than they have been in the past. So it, if you're right, you're in a position to make money. You don't have to have come up with some new way of producing the tennis balls. It's just you correctly anticipate some change in demand. So remember, the entrepreneur does not have to rely on technological innovation, although that's sometimes a way that many entrepreneurs do get their profit. So then we've got so far, so we've already hinted at what the answer is. We said, well, how we have the problem is to say everything was bad for the masses up to, say, end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. Then things started to get substantially better for people. So how did this happen? We said, well, it isn't just that people came up with new ideas, like new inventions, because we could come up with cases like India in the 1950s when people had access to all these great new ideas, but the masses were still doing very badly. So what's the answer? What Mises and Hazlitt stressed is that the reason for this takeoff into prosperity, I'm using takeoff, that was a word made famous in a book by Walt Whitman Rostow called The Stages of Economic Growth. He had a very, he wasn't a supporter of the free market, but I'm just using that phrase and made popular, takeoff. We have a takeoff into prosperity that began near the end of the 18th century. Now, what the reason for this was an increase in investment. People were saving and investing. And why did this make things better for the masses of people, for the workers, if people were investing? Well, it's because of increases in capital goods, workers are more productive. Supposing, to take the example of the spinning jenny, people were able to spin much more cloth than they had before, because they have access to this new equipment, or people who were able to use a steam engine would be able to produce much more than they had without it. So if you have increases in capital goods, workers are more productive. They're able to produce more. Probably their physical ability hasn't changed very much, but because they have access to the superior equipment, then they're going to be much more productive. So how does that help them? You might say, well, if they're more productive, that'll certainly help the person who owns the factory or wherever it is they're working, because he'll be getting more valuable products or more than he was getting before. But how does this help workers? And the answer to that is, and this would be something we would cover in other courses in Austrian economics, where we can see the basis of it, it's pretty commonsensical, is that how much pay a worker gets depend on how productive the worker is. And we can see the reason for that is, suppose an employer is thinking, do I want to hire a worker? When would it? I want to hire this worker? I want to ask, what is the worker in a position to do for me? That'll depend on how much his contribution is adding to the value of the product that he's making. So if he's able to contribute more to the product, then he'll be worth more. Now you might say, well, what if the employer just says, well, I'm not going to give the worker what everything is worth. He's worth, I'll just give him a very low amount, then he won't be able to refuse. Well, it doesn't work out that way in a competitive economy. If he offers less than what the workers producing, then other firms are going to bid the worker away. So workers in a capitalist economy will tend to be paid according to how productive they are. And if there's an increase in capital goods that makes them more productive, then their pay is going to get up. So that's really, you see, quite simple, really. The answer to the question is, how did they get to be, how did things get so much better for workers in the beginning, in the 19th century? How do we get this takeoff so workers can afford all these nice things like housing and light and indoor plumbing, television, all sorts of other things? It's that they became more productive. They became more productive because they had access to capital goods, and they had increased capital goods because people are saving and investing money. So the basic point is that it's the increase in investment that made the new prosperity for workers possible and actual. Now, there's a complication that needs to be added to what we've already said. So what we've said so far is the work conditions improve for workers because they get more productive when they have access to capital goods, but new capital goods just makes them more productive, so their wages go up. So the key to workers' prosperity is increased investment due to the fact that people are saving. Now, what we said is true, but there's a complication, is that it isn't always the case that the greater the capital investment, the higher wages rise. And why not? You might have thought, well, why wouldn't this be true? I mean, if, as long as workers are becoming more productive, then aren't they going to be getting higher wages? What would be the reason they wouldn't be? Well, we've left out in what we're saying so far the number of workers. We just said, suppose you have the same number of workers, say you have 10 workers in a factory, and then they suddenly get much more capital equipment, then they're going to be more productive. But what if you just kept adding more and more workers as the capital investment rose? Then wages wouldn't go up. And you can see basically why not. You would have a tendency as workers got access to the capital equipment, then the workers' productivity would be going up. But at the same time, what happens when you're adding more workers? Well, what happens when you increase the supply of any good? The price tends to go down. So we would have the worker productivity is increasing, it's going up. That'll tend to push wages up. But at the same time, if you have more and more workers coming on the scene, that'll push the wages down. So that's limiting how much the increases in investment will help the workers. So what Mises says is that the key to prosperity, we have to state this more exactly, it isn't just an increase in capital investment, but the key for worker prosperity or mass prosperity is the ratio between capital investment and the number of workers. So you take the increased capital investment and you divide it by the number of workers. And the greater amount you get, the better workers are, because then the individual worker will be much more productive and he'll be then able to get higher wages. And what Mises stress on this, at this point, that population growth can limit the effectiveness of capital investment in increasing wages, I think reflects a Malthusian element in his thought. Remember, Malthus was the one who said population is going to increase faster than food supply. So Mises didn't agree with that. He didn't think it was necessarily the case that population was going to increase faster than food supply. He thought workers, or people in general, could decide not to just have more children automatically when conditions got better for them. But still, he had this Malthusian element in that he thought there's an optimal population, optimal in the sense of most efficient. If you had more people than the optimal, that would tend to decrease wages. And it's interesting, I think, to ask, why did he think there's an optimal population? Again, optimal from the point of view of economic efficiency. Well, Mises said, and this is one thing you would get if you study human action, those of you who took, I gave courses on human action, part one, part two, and we covered that in those courses, is it's true for any factor of production. Remember, labor is just one factor of production. We have land and capital also. I say, or we can get this less general category, say we can take particular goods, say you need, say, to produce say anything you want. You need a plow, you need so much a particular kind of wood or steel or whatever it is plows are made of. You need so much labor, and so on. So for any factor production, you can't increase what's produced indefinitely by just increasing one factor and leave everything else the same. Suppose you said, well, okay, I need here's what I need to produce a plow. So then I'll just increase the labor, leave everything else the same, just keep increasing the labor. Then I get more plows, but if I keep doing that, I won't be adding more and more plows because just by increasing labor, leaving everything else constant. If I could do that, I wouldn't really need more than one factor of production. I could just substitute labor for all the other factors of production. But so for any factor of production, there's an optimal amount of it, and after that we reach the so-called point of diminishing returns. This is what's called the law of return. Basic point, I've probably gone and explained it in a too complicated way. The basic point is simple. It's just for a factor of production, including labor, you can't just keep increasing it indefinitely and get more and more production. So this is why you'd have an optimal population, because if you increase population enough, then you won't be adding to productivity. So we've got, it's true that increases in capital equipment will make workers more and more productive, but if we keep adding enough workers, then it won't be the case that the increased workers will be adding to productivity, even if they're making use of the new capital equipment. You could just get so much from labor. It's just there's a limit to what you could get, just like with any other factor of production. Now, there's some people, some economists, like late Julian Simon was one of these, or what I call population optimists. And they would say, well, this, what Mises said is, look, you can't just keep increasing population indefinitely and things would get more and more productive. You'll reach a point where adding people won't increase productivity. So a population optimist could say, okay, you're right, but it would really take a tremendous increase in population to reach this point. We don't really have to worry about that for all practical purposes. We could just say, as far as we're concerned, we can have more and more people, and we'd have to get to really tremendous numbers of people before we have to start worrying about maybe we're getting so many people will be decreasing productivity. So what those people would say is, as long as we have the increased capital investment, things are going to keep getting better for workers. We don't have to worry about the effects of overpopulation on standard of living. Now, Simon appears to go further. He says, maybe we don't need to worry about this at all, because he thought the more people there are, the more people come up with new ideas. So people always, if there were problems caused by too many people, people would just be more likely to come up with ideas to solve those problems. It's just like, say, some people say they have that view, and Simon's one had this view on problems generated by the environment, so-called environmental pollution or global warming, if there is such a thing. I'm inclined to think there's good to be skeptical about that one, but I mean, there's a lot of people who believe that. But there are people who say, well, look, as long as we get the more people we have, chances are somebody's going to come up with some way of solving whatever those problems are. So Simon and other people were population optimists, but whether they were right or not, what we should take note of is that Mises was not a population optimist. He thought, when he was talking about optimal population, he wasn't just talking about some theoretical possibility that, you know, maybe when we have 50 billion people on the earth, we'll have to start worrying about that. He thought that was something that really people were faced with. And I think it would be his view, say, if you look at the population of India when he was writing, I think he would think India or China was then overpopulated. Whether he was right or not, as I say, is not something I want to go into here. I wouldn't have the knowledge to be able to speak to that, although I think there's quite a bit in what Simon was saying. But Mises did not agree with that. He thought population was really if you increase population beyond the levels of that are certainly within reach of people, you're going to get into big trouble. There were other economists, free market economists, who thought that way. You might look at a book by Wilfred King called The Keys to Prosperity that's stressing the need for population limits. Now, suppose, though, putting aside problems of population, suppose we say prosperity requires investment, because remember, the way workers will get more money is if they have access to better capital goods, and you need investment for that. So how can a nation, let's say imagine you're in the Indian government in the 1950s, you want conditions to improve. So what are you going to do? Well, you don't do what Nehru and his colleagues did. You want to attract investors into your country, especially foreign investors, because they're the ones who have the money. And how are you going to get investors in your country? Well, one thing you have to do is you have to assure the investors, you have to make them believe that the government isn't going to confiscate their businesses or their profits, because those investors said, oh, well, here is some nice way of I can make a lot of money in India. The workers I wouldn't have to pay workers as much as I would in the U.S., so why don't I set up a factory over there and then I can make a lot of money. That isn't going to work if the government says to the investor, okay, fine, you're making a lot of money, so we're just going to come in and nationalize your factory and take everything away from you. Investors aren't stupid, or at least not that stupid. They're going to be aware that the government might do that, and then they won't invest. So even though this seems pretty obvious, saying, well, if you want somebody to invest in your country, you better make sure that you have good conditions for the person, the investor, and the good certainly good condition would be you're not going to seize his investment. Many governments don't do this, and on the contrary, they do seize investments. They do say, well, look, here's a chance. Look, this company's making a lot of money. We're going to take this, or this oil company is coming in there, exploiting the national resource that belongs to the whole people, so we don't want them to do that. We're just going to come in and nationalize their investment. So if they do that, it's not very surprising that investors won't want to go there. And we could ask, well, why do they do that? It doesn't seem very difficult to see that it isn't a good thing to do to confiscate investments. If you want investment, then since it's not a very involved piece of reasoning, it isn't as if we ask people to explain the money regression theorem or something like that. Just saying, look, if people want to investment, it isn't a good idea to seize what they're going to make. So we could say Mises uses the phrase climate of opinion was against capitalism, the climate of opinion. People, the so-called enlightened or educated people, were very anti-capitalist at that time. They still are to a large extent, but it was even more in the 1940s and 50s. And the phrase climate of opinion, or climates of opinion, is an interesting phrase. It was actually used, popularized in the 20th century by the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead in a book called Science in the Modern World. He wasn't talking about capitalism or the economic system, but he used the phrase climates with an S of opinion, and that became very popular. I think the phrase originally comes in the 18th century by an English writer named Joseph Glanvill, but it was Whitehead who popularized it, so that's where Mises is really getting that phrase from. I'm sure you've heard other people use the climate of opinion. It's kind of a nice metaphor, I think. So it comes from Whitehead. The idea Mises has is very similar to a notion that the contemporary libertarian economic historian Robert Higgs had called regime uncertainty. Higgs argues that the depression in America in the 1930s was made worse than it had to be. Remember, if we look, say, compare conditions in the 1930s in America, say, with what happened, there was a depression in 1920 to 21. The economy recovered very fast from that. But in the 30s, after the collapse of the economy in the great October 1929 stock market crash, afterwards, the economy didn't really recover. It kind of limped through the 1930s. There was a secondary depression in 1937. And Higgs says, well, a principal reason that things weren't going very well for America in the 30s was that business people didn't know what Franklin Roosevelt was planning. He was always coming up with new schemes on how to run the economy. Business people didn't know what he was doing. They didn't know, well, maybe if they invest in things, Roosevelt's going to come up with some new taxes and they'll lose everything. So they were very reluctant to invest. So see, this is very similar to what Mises is saying about foreign investments in India and elsewhere. He says, if the investor is faced with confiscation of his investment, he's not going to be very reluctant to invest. And this is very much like what Higgs is saying. He says if people are uncertain what the government's going to do, then that'll be very bad for investment. And the notion Higgs had, he was really, he'd been influenced by a very important economist who was at the Chase Manhattan Bank in the 1930s and wrote a book called Economics and the Public Welfare. This was Benjamin Anderson. He also emphasized very strongly how uncertainty about what the government is doing is very bad for investment. So what Mises is arguing thus so far is that taking away income and wealth from the rich really won't help the poor. Because what is his argument is if you take away income and wealth for the rich, that'll discourage investment, just the way we've seen it. Say a businessman is going to invest in a project. If you take away his profits, take away his earnings, or tax them, then he's going to be reluctant to invest. And of course, as we've tried to go over in this lecture, probably you think too many times, is that the way the masses get to be prosperous is that increased investment will result in greater access for the workers to capital, because this will increase their productivity and that will push their wages up. So if you take away income and wealth from the rich, this really won't help the poor. It'll discourage investment. Now you notice the type of argument Mises is giving, it's not, strictly speaking, an appeal, not really an appeal to justice or rights. He's not saying, say as many libertarians would, look, if you're taxing people, you're taking away what's rightfully theirs. Mises is making more of an argument saying, look, you say you want to help the poor, but what you're suggesting won't help them all that much. So it isn't really an appeal to a particular ethical theory. It's just saying you won't be doing what you think you're doing if you confiscate wealth. You're trying, you say you want to help the poor, but just taking away income and wealth won't do it. On the contrary, it'll hurt the poor because it'll discourage investment. Mises also has supplementary argument, I think is an interesting one, is he says that suppose you say, okay, well, maybe you have this possible loss to workers by discouraging investment, but that's all very speculative. I know that if I tax money away from the rich people, I know, well, at least I've got that money. I can distribute that to people. So forget about the long run, King's famous statement, the long run, we're all dead. If you confiscate money from the wealthy, you know, you have quite a bit of money you could then distribute to people. So Mises says, well, if you do this, if you confiscate wealth from people, from rich people, and you just divide it up among a lot of people, everybody, it won't actually amount to all that much. So if you say to Mises, okay, I'm going to disregard your argument about long-term effects on investment. I'm just going to go for the immediate confiscation and we'll have this wealth we can distribute to everybody. We can forget about the long run. Mises said this won't work either. And I did. Now, this I must warn you about. I'm very, very bad at computation, so it could well be that I've done this incorrectly. But what I did was, suppose you take Bill Gates, who's worth about $67 billion, according to what I looked up. That's quite, I must say, I don't, not revealing any much of a secret, that's a good deal more than what I'm worth. So supposing you took, you confiscated this $67 billion and you divided that amount equally among the U.S. population, which is about 311 million people, what would each person get? Well, I think it would be about $215 each, which be certainly nice to have. I like to have $200, but it isn't all that much. In fact, I may have made a mistake in computation there, but you see, Mises' basic point is, okay, if you say you're going to confiscate money from the rich and give it to the poor, you're not going to really be able to get very much, and there are very substantial reasons not to do it, and that you'll be discouraging investment. Okay, so I think that'll be it for this lecture, and we'll now go to the questions, comments, objections. Okay, wait, here's one here. Travis asked, just to reconfirm from the lecture, Mises believed that money is required for every entrepreneur to launch his enterprise. Is that correct? But isn't it possible that entrepreneurs can start their enterprise with little or no capital? Essentially, is the only way for visionary entrepreneurs to get started is through VCs and other investor types? Well, that's a very good question, Travis. I mean, there are cases where somebody gets started on not much capital, but essentially you do have to have resources to get started. I mean, you have to have somebody who's going to be backing the money, because if you don't, say, what you could do, say you could start with not very much, and then when you get your people buy it, then you could just plow the money back into the company. You could build up capital that way, but you really have to have money in order to invest. And I think people tend now too much to talk about a so-called knowledge economy, as if we could get the, just eliminate physical goods, but the economy really is based on actual money, actual goods. I mean, some people have the view, oh, if only we abolish patents and copyrights, we're going to be transported into a paradise where everybody will just have access to knowledge and will for free, and things will be quite wonderful. And I think that's very exaggerated. It's a very un-Misesian way of looking at things. Let's see, Kenya asked, could the entrepreneur decide not to raise wages even though workers' productivity increases? Well, suppose an entrepreneur said that. He said, okay, I'm going to keep the gains for myself. You know, why should, you're helping me, but why should I give you more? Then it will be then in the interests of some other firm to say to that worker, well, you're more productive, so I can offer you a little more than what this kind of Scrooge-like employer is giving you. I can give you more. There'll be a tendency to the person who refuses to raise wages will tend to lose workers to competing firms that do. Now you say, why would the competing firm offer more? Well, it's to their advantage to do so because the workers are more productive, so they can make more money by hiring them away from the other firm. So that's in that you're saying what push them to increase the wages. That was it. It's the prospect of profits that the competitors will offer more, because that's the prospect of profits will make it advantageous for them to do that. So what pushes this original entrepreneur doesn't want to raise wages to do so is he doesn't want to lose workers to competing firms. Malcolm said, did Mises ever write an article or a book on population and or optimal population? How to determine, did Rothbard write on this or any others you recommend? Who has written on what are the factors that affect population growth or decline. Well, I think Mises mentions this from time to time in Human Action. I don't think he ever wrote a book on it and how to return. I think Rothbard didn't write on that either. I think Rothbard would probably be more sympathetic to the view you could just, we don't really have to worry much about population increase. I think Colin Clark, who is an Australian economist, is a good one to write on that to read on that topic. He had and Julian Simon would be one also written on that. But and I say this earlier book called Keys to Prosperity by Wilford King, W-I-L-F-O-R-D King, had a view, I think, rather like Mises on population. But I say if you, the other view you could get in the books, just look up Julian Simon or Colin Clark and you can see that. But I mean, it's, I don't think Mises or Rothbard ever addressed population growth in any detail. Travis said, the reason why I ask this is that socialist leaning people then say, what if you're born poor versus someone who was born into a wealthy family? The latter person has access to capital to start an enterprise, where the former has no access, and even is more creative and visionary to start an enterprise, has no access to capital, and therefore remain permanently stuck in his economic level. Well, I think what's wrong with that way of looking at things is, suppose you're poor and you have some creative ideas, you can then go to somebody who's an investor and say, well, I've got this new idea. Let's, if you give me money to support it, you'll be very profitable for you and I'll be able to make money too. So, you see, it just doesn't follow that if you don't have access to capital to begin with, you're going to remain stuck in a low level. You can just attract people to invest in your ideas. And it's generally true, I mean, that poor people aren't, who have ability aren't stuck in their own level. Let's say a poor person is very smart and gets a scholarship to go to college and then gets a very good job. And you wouldn't say, well, because he started off poor, he's doomed to remain poor. I mean, what would be the basis for saying that? And remember, one thing we try to stress in this course, probably the most, is the way people become wealthy in a capitalist economy is they're able to produce something that the consumers want. It's really the consumers are really running the show, because business people and others will make money depending on how well they satisfy consumer demands. I'm going to hear something. Wait a sec here. Oh, this is Travis has one very important. In his essay titled Why Socialism, Albert Einstein rejects capitalism and endorses socialism as being the best economic system for humanity. He states in his essay that private capital tends to be concentrated in few hands, partly because of competition among the capitalists and partly because technological development and increasing division of labor encourage the formation of larger units of production at the expense of smaller ones. The result of these developments is an oligarchy of private capital, the enormous power of which cannot be effectively checked even by a democratically organized political society, and that, quote, production is carried on for profit, not for use. There is no provision that all those able and willing to work will always be in position to find employment. This crippling of individuals, I consider the worst evil of capitalism. Are you, and was Mises aware of Einstein's views against capitalism? Did Mises ever refute Einstein? Well, I'm sure he was aware. I mean, Einstein was a very popular person. People paid a lot of attention to him. But the point Einstein was making that essay, of course, Einstein was one of the greatest of all innovators in physics. But what he was saying in that particular essay wasn't some really amazingly new idea. That was just an old view that the Marxists had. There's an inevitable tendency of firms in a capitalist economy to coalesce around larger and larger firms until you had a few large firms and monopolies dominating the economy. Now, what's the matter with that idea? Well, in some cases, it is true that larger firms are more productive than smaller firms, but by no means always. And remember, there's something we talked about in this lecture that will enable you to have the resources to show what's wrong with that argument. Remember, we talked about the law of returns. The law of returns says if you just increase the factors of production, keep everything else the same, you won't increase productivity indefinitely. What the most efficient way of producing something is will vary according to the particular product. It isn't always the case that the bigger the better. So sometimes large firms aren't more efficient than smaller firms and don't drive them out of business. And in fact, in the United States, other large developed capitalist countries, it isn't the case that most industries are run by just a few very small companies. There are some industries like that, but not by no means all of them. Now, the other point in Einstein's remarks was, well, what if there are workers who are willing and able to work, but they're not offered employment? Well, here again, that's an appeal to a Marxist view called this the reserve army of the employed. But that isn't such a very good view, because good thing, suppose somebody's able to work and willing to work, meaning he can contribute to some employer's product, it would be to the advantage of the employer to offer him some work because he's contributing to the product and he wouldn't be paid more than he's producing, so it would be to the advantage of an employer to hire people. So I say, I don't think, you know, I mean, Einstein was a great genius in physics, but one thing, it very often doesn't carry over somebody's good in one subject to other subjects. So I don't think Einstein's views are really that worthy of attention. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'd have to check this, but I believe Einstein's brother was actually a professional economist who had studied Austrian economics. I'd say maybe instead of, when you talk about reading Einstein, maybe you should study the brother instead of Albert Einstein. Travis says, Einstein was even wrong on E equals MC squared. He admits this in writings later. What scares me is that people think he's a genius on everything. So when he says this, people say, aha, we must all become socialists now. Einstein says, oh, there, we must do it. Well, as far, and I think that's very interesting. As far as I'm not aware that Einstein ever gave up his theory of special or general theory of relativity, but no doubt you know more than I do on this point, but I wasn't aware of that. Leslie says, it means to consider cultural facts as being important in economic development, such as a work-saving ethic. Yes, I'm sure he would have. I mean, he stressed a lot that people can come under the influence of bad ideas, especially anti-capitalist ideas. But this is the importance of a cultural factor, something you find also in Rothbard and others. So I think certainly he would. I think he would think that's important. I don't think. He didn't tend to, I don't think he, Mises wrote that much on particular virtues that people need to have in order to work under capitalism. And one thing he does stress is the importance of long-run self-interest as opposed to immediate gratification. You find that in Henry Hazlitt, the Foundations of Morality. I have a lecture on that book that you might listen to. I think it's available for free. So that would be, I think, one thing is the importance of being able to concentrate on long-term interests. That would be vital to economic development. Now, I don't want to, of course, one way you could put this is stress that people, if people have too high a rate of time preference for immediate gratification to the future, that will impede economic development. I don't want to stress that too much, but Hans Hoppe did that when he was at Las Vegas and got into tremendous trouble. Mountains, where is that lecture? The name, which lecture was that? Travis says, an oligarchy of private capitalists, perhaps one of the biggest arguments that socialists make against capitalism. Should we respond to this like explaining economics is not a zero-sum game? Or what is the best way for us to go about demissing this? Well, I think it's just this, that what you say is very right, that there isn't a tendency in capitalism for the economy to be taken over by a few large firms. And an oligarchy, I think what's wrong with that phrase, oligarchy is a political system. It's ruled by the rich. But in a capitalist economy, the fact that someone owns a firm doesn't give him political control over anything. So it's just the phrase is mixing in the political concept into an economic one, suggesting that capitalist economy is one that's politically controlled by large capitalists, and that's by no means the case. You see, it's just kind of a confusing, it's a question begging way of looking at things to speak of an oligarchy of capital. And now, let's see, what do you say? Malcolm says, I missed the name of the lecture you just mentioned. You gave great time preference and investing in the future by delaying current breaks. Oh, no, I didn't give a lecture. I just said Hans Hoppe. That was somewhat of a joke. Hans Hoppe at Las Vegas got into tremendous, he taught at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, got into tremendous trouble because he said he's talking about people he considered high time preference people, and he made some very politically incorrect remarks. You just look up Hans Hoppe in Las Vegas and Google that, you'll come up with the controversy. It was several years ago, it was in the mid-1990s, I think, or maybe a little later than that. It created a tremendous stir at the time, so that was all I meant. And David Corwin says, Mises writes, as the prosperity of a nation, the height of wage rates depends on a continual increase in the capital investment in its plants, mines, and farm, is one of the foremost tasks of good government to remove all obstacles that hinder the accumulation and investment of new capital. Mises' theory seems to be based on production, factories, farms, and mines. How would he square this with current outsourcing, automation, offshore investment, foreign workers, slaves, etc.? Well, remember, if you take the original quotation by Mises, it isn't limited to investment within one country. It's all investment is increasing productivity. It's not just investment in particular types of goods. Outsourcing would, that's helping the people who are in those lines of work. Now, if you say, well, what about, it doesn't, outsourcing, isn't decreasing wages for workers within the U.S. because one thing Mises stresses is there are always new wants that people have. If you have automation or outsourcing, then that will just free up other labor for other things that they can do. It isn't that, well, there's only just a very limited number of jobs, so if you give certain jobs to foreign people, then that'll just drive American people, workers, out of work and make them permanently unemployed. So I don't think what you're suggesting, I think, would not be a correct way of looking at things. At least that isn't the way Mises would look at it. Now, Travis says, what exactly did you say that caused any controversy? I really like Hoppe, as long as he doesn't go into paleo-libertarianism, which scares me. Well, I don't want to go into it in detail, but essentially he suggested that there were certain groups of people who would tend to have high time preference rates, and these groups of people are ones that are in kind of certain minority groups that you could sometimes get into trouble if you say bad things about them. Now, Malin says, while Rothbard in MES with Power Market correct some things that Mises said, wrote, what would be the differences that Mises had with Rothbard's views at the end of Mises' life? Well, I think they were very much in accord with and most parts of economic theory. Mises didn't accept Rothbard's theory of monopoly, that when Rothbard says in chapter 10 of Man, Economy, and State, there can't be a monopoly price on the free market. Mises didn't agree with that, although he thought that the conditions for having monopoly price on the free market were very hard to reach. And Mises didn't accept Rothbard's natural rights approach to libertarian theory. Mises was a utilitarian, so I think those would be two main areas where they wouldn't agree. Now, Leslie says, did Keynes really change from being an advocate of laissez-faire to an interventionist? Given the climate of opinion in England in the early 20th century, was he ever really a believer in classical liberalism? Did Laskin British socialists influence Keynes? Well, I think Keynes I don't think he ever explicitly favored laissez-faire. You know, he was writing the essay, The End of Laissez-Faire, in the 1920s. But I mean, when he started off, he was a fairly standard economist who was somewhat sympathetic to capitalism, although in his book, Economic Consequences of the Peace, he rather makes fun of saving. He said, well, people are just saving to build up for a cake that's never consumed, although he then does suggest there are really benefits for saving. I don't think Keynes would pay attention to Laskin, the British socialist. He was quite a bit smarter than they were, so I don't think he really pay attention to their economic views. They really wouldn't have anything to teach them. It would be more, I think, the British socialists and Lasky would be learned from Keynes rather than the other way around. Now, Travis says, libertarian anarchy is equated as the tyranny of the rich by socialists and anarchist socialists. That's why I'm trying to figure out how best to get this from an Austrian perspective. Well, I think you have to, again, you have to watch out for this mixing of a political category with an economic category. The capitalist system is not one where the rich people are ruling, but one where the consumers are really in control and people get rich by satisfying the consumers. Now, Malcolm says, how or by what factors it means that a monopoly could be established in a free market without government, religious, some form of state intervention? Well, I think what he had principally in mind was something like someone has control of a particular of the total supply of a particular natural resource, something like, say, someone owns all the diamonds mines in the world, so there's a limited number of them, and he happens to own them also, then I think Rafa wouldn't deny you could have somebody owning all of a certain resource, but then the question is not whether you can have a monopoly, but whether the monopolist can then establish a monopoly price that's different, that's to say a price different from the competitive price. And Mises thought in certain, if someone controlled all the supply of a resource, then depending on how the demand curve was shaped, depending on how people demanded that what prices, what quantities people would pay for it, various prices of the good, it could be that someone could get a monopoly price. And Rothbard said, no, there's no way of specifying what a distinguishing monopoly from a competitive price in the free market, so he rejected the whole concept. So I think you should read this chapter 10 of Man, Economy, and State. Now, Travis says, here's another question. Sorry for asking so many. Although there's nothing to be sorry about, you have good questions. In a narco-capitalist society, what would prevent the wealthiest capitalists from forming a coalition taking on state-like demeanor, sense that they could all agree to raise their minimum wages, initiate price control, etc., the means to stifle their competitors and innovative, disruptive enterprise from up-and-coming entrepreneurs. No libertarian anarchists ever discussed such a scenario or possibility. Well, see, what would happen there, and this is when Rothbard does have things to say about this, you know, this is similar to what people promise having what they call oligopoly pricing. If you had a coalition of people say, well, we're just going to forget about libertarian rules, we're just going to take over, that would be very unstable because individual members of the coalition might benefit from defecting from it. They could form alliances with other people. So there would be, it wouldn't be very easy to keep such a coalition together. And again, of course, in an anarchist society, as Leslie said, members always cheat in a cartel. So I think that would be, that's certainly something we could expect. Well, okay, so I guess we're about out of time now. So thanks very much, everybody. One thing, I saw some question from where was this earlier, from David Corwin. Are you the one who sends me comments on my, David, are you the one who sends me the comments on my review sometimes? Very interesting comment, taking issue with some of the things I say, or am I misremembering this? I always enjoyed getting such comments. Oh no, so it's not you. Oh, sorry, I confused with someone else. I think I had the same name. Okay, well, thanks everybody. Hope to see you next week, which is the last week. Thanks everybody. Bye-bye.